Starting, as I said, starting next week, we will starting next week we will hopefully pick up the pace. But in order to be able to do the, to look at the three statements that are attributed to Anshei Knesset HaGdola, we really need to look at five words. Unevim Nesaru La Anshei Knesset HaGdola. The prophets passed the Torah Shebal Peh onto the members of the Great Assembly, who were the authority in the period from the return to Eretz Israel around in the 530s, all the way down to approximately the conquest of Eretz Israel by the Seleucid Greeks in around the year 200.
Even though it's, I always find it interesting that in neither Ezra nor Nehemiah uses Anshei Knesset HaGdola.
That's true. But you can see that they're involved with, in fact, exactly the kinds of activities that are attributed to Anshei Knesset HaGdola. For example, in the great that we're not going to look at today, but in the great covenant ceremony, they all sign on and we accept the Torah and so on and so forth. We're going to talk about that a little bit. They're actually in the things that they're accepting are also things that we know are derabbanan. So in other words, Anshei Knesset HaGdola, one of the things they do is they start to legislate. They, according to Chazal, they legislate the prayer service and they structure it. And they do all kinds of other things, which are a part of their function as a bezdin.
And is there a reason they step in as opposed to Kohanim?
Oh, okay. Well, Kohanim involved.
How are that?
Well, you know, it's funny. You start having non-Kohen. You start having non-Kohen. Leaders in, already in time, so time by the end. Well, no, that's later.
Yeah.
Okay, but you already have Kohanim, Kohanim and non-Kohanim involved in, documentedly involved in Torah Shebal Peh at the end of Bayis Rishon already, because you have Shafaniyos HaSofer and Baruch HaSofer. These Sofrim, these are the proto. They're another chain they're another point in the chain. However, what's striking, that the leader up until the beginning of the time Anshei Knesset HaGdola is in fact a prophet, right? But the problem with that, and that is that we saw consistently that there is a lot of tension. There's a lot of question as to whether Nevi'im, in their role as Nevi'im, have a right to an opinion. So anyway, Nevi'im play a central role. Now there's a problem, because there is a problem, not just according to the Rambam, that prophets qua prophets shouldn't that don't paskin. So how does that work? And what does it mean Nevi'im Sarul Anshei Knesset HaGdola? What was the implication? Now there was an overlap, because the last three Nevi'im, Anshei Knesset HaGdola, Chagai, Zecharia, Malachi, are members of the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. Chazal are not clear who Malachi is. There are two opinions. One opinion, the majority opinion, appears to be that Ezra is Malachi.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and the other opinion, minority opinion, is that Malachi is in fact Mordechai. That after the whole thing with Purim, Mordechai comes to Israel and he joins the Sanhedrin, which is the reason. Well, I'll explain it, but.
Why are you looking to give him someone else's persona?
Because in general, Chazal have a tendency to try to coordinate and say and to identify known figures with unknown figures. If San Zavoa, the Malachi is enough of a major player that and it fits that Malachi as a prophet would say Zichro Taras Moshe Avdi at the end of his day, and Ezra is the one who has the final covenant moment at the beginning of Bayis Sheni. But I wanted to mention that there is a minority opinion among the Midrashim that Mordechai is, as I said, is Malachi. That's the reason why in Italy for many centuries, people whose name was Mordechai, their English name or their Italian name was Angelo.
Oh.
That's one thing. Get that in. Okay, in any event, so...
What were you going to ask? Do you ask about Anshei Knesset HaGdola in general?
Yeah, I just...
Yeah,
mentioned in...
Because there's a lot of things that there's a lot of materials not mentioned in Tanakh, and in the Torah Shebal Peh, that's exactly what Torah Shebal Peh does, which is to supplement. Clearly, Anshei Knesset HaGdola grow out of that the founding assembly, which is either started by Chagai Zecharia Malachi or by the moment when Ezra comes and he has this big.
It seems to be a contained unit. Once the die out, so that's it. as opposed to an ongoing
Sanhedrin. It's not clear. That's not clear because you have at the end the next Mishnah is going to be that Shimon HaTzadik is from the last members of the Anshei Knesset Gedola. That's in 200.
Oh, right.
That's 200. You're talking a good 400 years worth of. Whether they met all the time, that's another story. We don't know. In fact, that's the big black hole of Jewish history. We have no idea about the Persian period. We even have a little bit less knowledge about the Ptolemaic period, a little bit more. But the Persian period, I mean, the 400s and the 300s. Yeah, but what's that? It's a bunch of Jewish mercenaries sitting on an island.
So they referred to a governor put there in Yahud from the Persians.
Beseder. So we know that there was no. We know that from Ezra that there was a governor and there was Yahud was the name of the province. Oh, that by the way, we don't know anything about internal Jewish life at the time.
Right.
So in other words, so Anshei Knesset Gedola are there's a tremendous. We just don't know. We know they existed, we know the function, we know that some of the things they did. For example, one of the things they did was ordain Purim, which we're going to get to in a second. Okay? That's where Mordechai comes in. But the point is that in terms of structure, you have to understand historically that there's a fundamental shift from religious institutions that are headed up by a Navi, whether they function qua Navi or not, okay, and the people coming afterwards, and that's what I want to look at. So what
most of our co-host speakers are not to use Gemara for any historical veracity at all.
That's not fair. That's not fair. First of all, it depends on what you use. First of all, there's no reason to totally discount Chazal's historical recounts. Sometimes Chazal give you historical information in a more of a narrative form where there's a germ of where there's a historical core which they're trying to advance. They make a difference. Sometimes they make a deeper point about historical events that that perhaps didn't under no circumstances. Look at what Rabban Rambam says in the introduction to his whole discussion on drushas and agados. So Rabban Rambam says, listen, when it comes to science, he says, Chazal knew what they knew, and they don't have absolute. There's no dogmatic need, says Rabban Rambam, and apparently this is what the Rambam's position was, to accept the Chazal on issues of science. And you could say something similar with regard to history. Chazal knew what they knew, but their point was not to provide historical fact, at least not always. But some there's other stories. Other times, there's no reason not to accept them. Why would you not? I mean, there's all kinds of things.
I guess the purpose wasn't to record history, so maybe they're telling things.
Maybe, but sometimes they give metaphors. Sometimes metaphors. Yeah, I'm saying. You have to take it point by point. I mean, look at. For example, I think that there's these famous stories about Jesus' crucifixion that are found in the Gemara that were censored out. You don't need to take them literally. You can take them, but if you look very, very carefully, they tell you a tremendous amount about Chazal's attitude towards early Christianity and towards the persons involved. I mean, so the question is, what are Chazal trying to convey over here, and what not? But I certainly, under no circumstances, would dismiss Chazal like that because it's not fair. B, it's not respectful. And C, it's I think very superficial. I think it's extremely superficial to take that position with regard to massive amounts of what Chazal say, even with historical upshot. Okay. In any event, I would give Chazal. I think you always have to give Chazal the benefit of the doubt. What I want to talk about is I want to show you precisely what happened. That the shift from the Nevi'im to the Anshei Knesset Gedola is not just the usual passing on things from this Gedola to this to that. It was a real break, and it caused it threw up a lot of dust, and it caused a tremendous amount. It changed the nature of what advancing Torah Shebe'al Peh is about. Take a look. At the beginning of the period, Anshei Knesset Gedola, the end of the period of Nevuah, however you want, you have the following story in Zechariah. Okay, Vayihi Bishnat, I have the English and the Hebrew. Vayihi Bishnat Darbala Dayavash HaMelech, Hayad Var Hashem El Zechariah Barba Asad Lachodesh Hachi B'Kislev. So he got the following message on the 4th of Kislev. Vayishlach Beit El Saretzer. V'regem melech v'nashav l'chalot p'nei Hashem. At that point, two major figures in the community in Eretz Yisrael, after the building of the Beis HaMikdash, came to ask God, wanted to know God's... To ask something of God. They asked the question of the Kohanim and the Nevi'im, asking, should I continue fasting on Tisha B'Av? They just built the Beis HaMikdash. Do I still have to fast on Tisha B'Av? Now, it's interesting, the way I read this pasuk, I think that the whole idea of Tisha B'Av grew from the bottom up.
Huh.
Okay? I think it was a matter of the people took upon themselves fast days and days of mourning. You see, Hayefke. There's nothing about Tzom at the moment. Hayefke. It's a velus.
Are you sure the temple's been built now?
At this point, yeah. Okay? But even if it's being built, even if it's just being rebuilt, it doesn't really matter. The point is that the 70 years are over and the Golos is being undone. So should I continue fasting on Tisha B'Av?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. My personal opinion is in fact that the fasts were not ordained from the top down, but rather from the bottom up, and they were then adopted by the Chachamim.
Or the temple's built and they don't go back.
Well, not everybody goes back.
I know. So, is the temple being built the crux?
Yeah, because that's undoing. Okay. Look at these guys want to stay in Golos. They pay a price. For example, the Levium, according to Chazal, according to Tanakh, didn't come back, and they were therefore penalized.
I mean, we'd have to say we're still in Golos because there's no temple. No matter.
We are in Golos to a certain degree, and that's why I don't personally am not in. I once was in favor of it, but now I changed my mind. Especially after last week I was in Har HaBayit, you see the difference.
Yeah.
I just missed the riots by a couple of hours, I found out. I could have been arrested too. So I used to be in favor of changing the Nusach of Nechem, because it's not Ha'ir Ha'avela, the city is no longer in war, but it really isn't. I mean, the Tiferet, the glory of the city, is the Beis HaMikdash, so that's really the question. In any event, should I continue to cry? Okay? And Vahid Var Hashem, and so Zechariah gets an answer from God. God, the Lord of Hosts, says to him, Emorah kol ha'am ha'aretz, tell the council, vela kohanim lo lemor, and tell the priest, ki tzamtem b'safot b'chamishi b'shvi'i. The fact that you've been fasting and mourning, bewailing, safot is hesped, is to eulogize, and the fifth month and the seventh month, what seventh month? That's no. That's Tzom Gedalia, the day. I'm telling you, these are what. In other words, it's clear that this comes from them. They took it upon themselves that these were critical days. And later we'll see that includes Asar B'Teves and includes, at the time, the ninth of Tammuz.
He says, "Did you fast for me?"
Did you fast for me? You did it for yourself.
That's why we always do it.
Beseder.
Wake us up.
In other words, did I tell you? Did I? You know, you took it on yourselves. V'chitochul v'chitishto alo atem ochlim v'atem ashotim. You make up your mind. Halo at advarim asher akarash. Not only that, but the ritual is not that important. Hallo et advarim asher karashem biyad hanevi'im harishon biyad Yerushalayim yoshevet ushleivav v'ares v'gotev v'negev v'shelah yoshev. You're supposed to do what I told you to, which is to build a proper moral religious society. Okay, fine. That's reaction number one. Later on, in the next parak, you have the following answer further. But notice how it comes in. Vayihi dvar Hashem tzvakot elai lemor. So God came to me and said, ko amar Hashem tzvakot som harvi'i, which is... the ninth of Tammuz, then the time of Bais Rishon. V'tzoma Chamishi and Tisha B'Av. V'tzoma Shvi, Tzom Gedalia. V'tzoma Asiri, Asar B'Teves. Yila Beis Yehuda, it will become a day of Sason V'Simcha, L'Moadim Tovim V'Aymet V'Shalom Mehavu. Bartik. In other words, Golos is over, they now Yomim Tovim. Finished. Okay? It's a long discussion in the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah. What's the deal today? Is it optional? Not optional? Is it as bad? Is it not as bad? It's not the issue. The issue is that for purposes of this Shaila, they asked Zechariah.
Oh, Navi.
Okay? They asked the Navi. And the question came, and the answer came back from the Navi in the form of a Nebuah. So you have to leave the Rambam out of this for a minute. How the Rambam is going to deal with this is not an issue right this minute. Okay, I can show you that in fact there were a lot of people who didn't hold like the Rambam, who thought that part of the operative authority, at least, of the Torah Shebaal Peh is the fact that Nevi'im are functioning not just as Talmidei Chachamim, but also as Nevi'im.
Could you say they're asking a Hashkafa
Kmusadik
question, not a...
No, it's a Shaila. Should I continue fasting? It's a very simple Rabbi. Should I fast or not fast? It's very simple. Mm-hmm. And not only that, but the Nevi'im is coming back and saying, no, today it's, now it's Yontif.
So I was told that Navi had a Navi hat and a Posek hat.
Correct. So that's the question. How do you deal with this?
He's wearing his Posek
hat. He's obviously wearing his Posek hat, but he says, Vayehid Var Hashem Tzvakot Elai Lemur. That's the problem. Kol Amar Hashem Tzvakot. That would be very nice. Okay? Unless you want to say that in my Posek hat, I am actually interpreting the word of God. That you have to interpret it that way or something like that. Okay.
What does it have to do with God per se, right? If it, as you said, came from the body. He also seems to say, you're not fasting for me.
Right, so he said, but God actually...
Halakhically, it means that I didn't command
it. I didn't command it. On the other hand, I'm saying, you know what, the message is, and that's probably the way that you can actually interpret it. That I'm telling you, this, the Nevuah is, the Gullus is over. That's the information. You will therefore derive your conclusions from that fact. Mm-hmm. But that's basically what
you will. I mean, we're talking in a halakha context.
So that's the question. It reads like a shayla. Should I continue to fast? And the first answer was, you didn't do it for me. And then the answer is, no.
What kind of answer is, you didn't do it for me in the halakha?
You took it upon yourself.
Right, so it was a minhag. It became
it was a minhag, which was then endorsed by apparently by Chachamim in the generation. It became regularized. We get to Purim. Yes, in fact, exactly like Purim. Purim started out because it was celebrated by the people in Pushushan, and then it was sent to the Chachamim. Correct. Exactly. By the way, there is a machlok, a very serious machlok. I understand that Rabbi Reicher talked about this on Shavuos. There is a serious machlokus among Rishonim. What is the source of authority of Minhagim? And that machlokus is a machlokus exactly on this point. The Rambam, Sfardim in general, were of the opinion that Minhagim, any Minhagim, to have any kind of Minhagim, Takanos, Kseros, in order to have any kind of valence, any kind of authority, have got to be from top down. They've got to be legislated. And in fact, the Rambam has in Chos Mamrim a whole thing. You set up a committee to see if it's viable, and then you vote, and then you has to be ratified by the majority of the Jewish people, at least the Jewish people in Israel. For the Rambam, Jewish people live outside of Israel and not Am Yisrael. They're individuals or something, I don't know, whatever it is. And that's one position. The other position, which is more common among Ashkenazim, I mean, medieval Ashkenazim, is that no, Minhagim can be ordained from on top, but they can also grow from the bottom. Because there is a residual prophetic capacity, but residual prophetic capacity that adheres to the Jewish people, and they can serve as a legislative, as legislation. In fact, their activity becomes a legal, their accepted activity by from people becomes a legal authoritative statement. As Professor Twersky said, on more than one occasion, that minig is a brisa. In other words, just like you have to take consideration for all kinds of written halachic sources, so similarly, the minig of Am Yisrael is by itself, it's self-validating. So it's a machlokas rishon.
The minig is even more powerful, because halacha has logic, and you can argue it as a minority. But the minig is, you're doing it because that's what we do.
No, well, right, but that's, but the question is, no, but it has to square, right, but it has to square at some level with, you may always, it's not, it would, look, it depends. In the 11th century, all right, in the 11th century, right. In the 11th century, up until the 12th century in Ashkenaz, you were right. That's what we do, and doesn't matter, I don't care if the Gemara says this way, I don't care if the Gemara says that way. The minig was to daven Ma'ariv, to say Kriya Shema late in the afternoon in the summer, and it's still light outside. The Gemara says you shouldn't say Kriya Shema until Tes Kochavim. Very nice, but we're just going on following our minig. Around the late end of the 11th century, there was a serious change of opinion. It was led to a significant degree by Rashi, and then continued by Balei Tosfos. And their position was no. If it's a brisa already, so if you have a machlokas between a brisa and a mishnah, so you have to square it. You can't just leave it like that. So ultimately, the minhagim, in order to maintain their valence, had to be squared into one way, shape, or form with the written sources of halacha. So the parameters are a bit more, because there is such a thing as a minhag tos.
Right.
as a second meaning, although I will tell you that in fact among Ashkenazim down until Poland at the earliest, as one postek writes in the 15th century, he says, I don't know any minhagim that we don't accept. You know, so it's not so, there was a statement by Rabbi Shlomo of Krems, is quoted in the Rosh on the beginning of Baba Basra. In any event, let's come back to the sources. Okay, like as I said, we know practically nothing about the Persian period. We know a little bit. We know more about the Egyptian Ptolemaic period of rule. But things really begun to come to a head, documentation, stuff like that, in the beginning of when the Syrians conquer Eretz Israel, and then you have Antiochus III, and then of course Antiochus IV, his famous son, infamous son, we should say. There are two passages in the Book of Maccabees, three passages in the Book of Maccabees that I want to show you that highlight what the words Minaviyam Masarua Lanchik Nesagdola mean for the people who are living in an era when there's no more prophets, because Malachi is the last prophet. We're talking now almost 300 years, 300 years, 270 years after the last Navi died. Okay.
Which is what?
For instance, the last Navi dies, 420, 440, the Maccabean Revolt breaks out in the 160s. Mm-hmm. Okay, BCE. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so it's a serious chunk of time. It's a serious chunk of time. Okay. I always get confused about the dates. I mean, it's in the 160s. In any event, it's 167. Yes, thank you. After Antiochus issues his first Gezeres, a lot of people tell us the Book of Maccabees 1 tell us that they ran into the mountains to hide. Okay, so now take a look. Maccabees 2:31-44. Then many who were seeking righteousness and justice, meaning they wanted to be Sharma Mitzvahs, went down into the wilderness to dwell there, they, their sons, their wives, and their cattle, because evils pressed heavily upon them, meaning the Greeks. And it was reported to the king's officers and to the troops in Jerusalem, the city of David, that men who had rejected the king's command, i.e., they would not worship Zeus, had gone down to the hiding places in the wilderness, because there's plenty of caves down there, right? Many pursued them and overtook them. They encamped opposite them and prepared for battle against them on the Sabbath. And they said to them, enough of this, come out and do what the king commands and you will live. But they said, we will not come out, nor will we do that with king demands, and so profane the Sabbath day. Then the enemy hastened to attack them, but they did not answer them or hurl a stone at them or block up their hiding places. For they said, let us die in our innocence. Heaven and earth testify for us that you are killing us unjustly. So they attacked them on the Sabbath and they died, and their wives and children and cattle to the number of 1,000 persons. When Matityahu and his friends learned of it, they mourned for them deeply, and each said to his neighbor, if we all do as our brethren have done, refuse to fight with the Gentiles for our lives and for our ordinances, meaning for the Torah, they will quickly destroy us from the earth. So they made this decision that day, let us fight against every man who comes to attack us on the Sabbath day. Let us not die as our brethren died in their hiding places.
Yeah, it's hard to take that as value because it takes so many centuries for Jews to realize that it's okay.
So that's the question. This is a historical account.
I know.
So the question is, what happened? And the historians sit there and go, first of all, let me tell you something. First of all, this doesn't bother me so much that up until this time people didn't know whether you're supposed to fight on Shabbos or not. For a very simple reason. Wars up until the Civil War are not total wars. They're set pieces.
Meaning
that they don't go on 24/7. You have two armies, they meet, they clash, goodbye. There were rules of war. It's almost like a dance. I mean, you pick your time and you pick them and you talk before the battle. I mean, it's perfect. I don't see any reason why this was not the least problematic. And religious historians, not just historians, sit there and wonder, said maybe, you know, they thought that the Bible was Muktzah, maybe, who knows what they thought. But what was striking is that, let's take the story at face value for a minute. It means that for the first time, okay, it means for the first time they had to consider b'mechallel Shabbos, and somebody had to take responsibility to say this Chilul Shabbos is mutter. Now we take that as second nature. Oh, of course, because Nefesh Dov Shabbos under all circumstances. Da, da. Whatever their considerations were, why they didn't fight back. Okay?
Well, is that an oral law? Is that
Torah Shabbat Peh? That's Torah
Shabbat Peh. Which is supposed to be given with Torah Shabbat Peh. So they should have known this.
That depends on how you understand. We had that story of Moshe Rabbeinu. The Torah Shabbat Peh continues to unfold according to the rules of Torah Shabbat Peh. But in this case, I think it's very clear. Matityahu, in his role as God Lador, he paskin the shaila, said, "Okay, whatever your considerations were over there, this is wrong." Okay. By the way, take a look at or maybe they were machmir too much themselves. You know, somebody had to go in, step in, and take and assume responsibility. Okay, maybe it was a mistake. Maybe they said no. You give me pikuach nefesh dov Shabbos, but they don't know that, or they for whatever reason think they shouldn't do it. It means that you have to justify saying no. You're all wrong. Go be mechal Shabbos for this. That's not an easy thing to do. Now you would. And my argument is that this story of Matityahu tells you that that was part of the challenge of living in a world where there's no more prophecy. Mm. You got to take it on yourself. Mm-hmm. That means being more courageous. He says, asking a prophet is no big deal. Well, then you get the validation right away.
It's hundreds of years after the last prophet.
Correct. So I'm saying this is an extreme example, but I'm telling you, but this is a situation which he's going up. You'll see two more passages where it's clear they still miss prophets.
Right.
Okay, take a look at the next one. After the brothers have conquered Eretz Yisrael, have conquered Jerusalem, they won the Battle of Emwas, and they went up and they took over the city. And then said Judah to his brothers, "Behold, our enemies are crushed. Let us go up to cleanse the sanctuary and dedicate it." So all the army assembled, and they went up to Mount Zion, and they saw the sanctuary desolate, the altar profaned, and the gates burned. In the courts they saw bushes sprung up as a thicket or as one of the mountains. They also saw the chambers of the priests in ruins. They then rent their clothes and mourned with great lamentation. And it was to keep looking. So they mourned with great lamentation and sprinkled themselves with ashes. They fell face upon the ground and sounded the signal of the trumpets and cried out to heaven. Then Judah detailed men to fight against those in the citadel until he had cleansed the sanctuary. The citadel was the Chakra. The Chakra was built by the Mityavnim to control the temple, and it sits. It's pretty clear that it sits on the spot, it sat on the spot where Al-Aqsa is. In other words, in the extension of Har HaBayit, on the platform, which is now where Al-Aqsa sits, that's where this citadel was. And it fell after.
It
was a fortress. Right. Just like later, under Herod, built at the north part of the Har HaBayit, a building which sits on which Al Maria School sits on, the Antonia, which serves the same function. That function was to have troops there to control the Beit HaMikdash in case of the Romans. In other words, you have different ends. Because by the time Herod takes over, the Hasmoneans had already taken the Chakra, destroyed it, and he had built the platform over it. But then the south extension of the Har HaBayit, of the platform of Har HaBayit, which was built by the Chashmonai, which was built by Herod, under that was the Chakra, evidently, which was where the Yavnim and Antiochus had people. So basically, while they were cleaning up the Beis HaMikdash, he sent soldiers to attack the Chakra, keep them busy so they could clean the Beis HaMikdash. He chose blameless priests devoted to the law, and it was obviously Kohanim who hadn't worshipped the Avodah Zarah, and they cleansed the sacred sanctuary and removed defiled stones to an unclean place. In other words, anything that had been involved in Avodah Zarah, they threw out. They deliberated what to do about the altar of burnt offering, which had been profaned, because they used it they put a statue of Zeus there. They sacrificed pigs on it, and they thought it best to tear it down, lest it bring reproach upon them, for the Gentiles had defiled it. Now comes the important line. So they tore down the altar and stored the stones in a convenient place on the temple hill, until there should come a prophet to tell what to do with them.
Ooh.
Now you could say in halachic terms, Achiavo Eliyahu, but notice there were shilas they didn't want to handle.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't feel the competence or they didn't feel they needed to, whatever the case might be, because there is no prophet. There is sort of a hinge here. There's something conditional in the way that the statement is here, that, you know, I'm only good as long as, you know, they still miss that validation.
When Gemara says the Alei Avodah is post Sanhedrin, in a world where there's no Sanhedrin, we'll say, or even
That's a good question. I'm only trying to note that this was a sentiment at the time. Okay? Now, then you finally hit, so that's 167. Yeah, 161, the war is over, and the last of the Hasmonean brothers becomes king. Chapter 14, 35, 41. The people saw Simon's faithfulness and the glory which he had resolved to win for his nation, and they made him their leader and high priest, because he had done all these things, and because of the justice and loyalty that he had maintained towards his nation. He sought in every way to exalt his people. And in his days things prospered in his hands, so that the Gentiles were put out of the country, as were also the men in the city of David in Jerusalem, who had built themselves a citadel from which they used to sally forth and defiled environs, in other words, the people in the Chakra. Shimon was the one who conquered the Chakra. I was waiting for this. He settled Jews in it and fortified it for the safety of the country and the city, and built the walls of Jerusalem higher. We know that. All the Hasmonean walls, and then his son Yohanan Hyrcanus, and his grandson Alexander Yonike. This is going to the 140s. Correct. In view of these things, King Demetrius confirmed him in the high priesthood. He gave him an offer he couldn't refuse. And he made him one of the king's friends and paid him high honors. For he had heard that the Jews were addressed by the Romans as friends and allies and brethren. It's also a very major consideration on the part of the Greeks, because the Romans, of course, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And that the Romans had received the envoys of Simon with honor. That this was a relationship which was started with Judah already, because it was brilliant. I mean, you're running a guerrilla war. What do? You make friends with the enemy. The Romans move troops to the border of the Seleucid Empire on the Dardanelles. And so Antiochus has to move troops away from the Judean front in order to be able to block the Romans, and that makes Judah's job even better. And of course, when you read the golden tablets that were put by eternal friendship and amity between Rome and the Jews forever, and so on.
But you always have to be careful who you get into bed.
Well, that's what happened. And the Jews and their priests decided that Simon should be their leader and high priest forever, until a trustworthy prophet. Again, why?
Well, we do know that who was supposed to return.
Correct, but the issue is, again, everything is conditional. Now, in this case, it was a matter of they had to take a chance, which, by the way, a lot of Chazal were not happy with, that he was both the king and the high priest. Not a happy combination. They were not happy with that.
Who was Demetrius?
Demetrius was the king of Syria. He was the brother or grandson of Antiochus. I don't remember. So there's a whole bunch of them still floating around there. But the point is that ultimately, like George III finally gave up, you know, he said you can be independent. So the same thing over here, Demetrius says, fine, you'll be independent, I have no more claims on you.
Is there a way of kind of like what we say in the days of Mashiach? Is it the same type of an idea?
Correct, but you're saying, but this is until a prophet should arise. I read this as saying, you know, I'm doing what I can, I'm taking responsibility, but I don't know. I'm lack that certitude. Well, there's that certitude is missing.
Well, all halacha, you take it over votes, and then you pass it. So here,
but you have to have guts.
So here, like, here with this sort of like not doing it, we're saying they are turning power over to Shimon as a prince.
Beside her.
But they're saying
no. He'll be the king. The word is king. He's ethnarch. He's the king. Right. He's the king and the high priest. That combination is unparalleled.
Forever, until a trusted prophet should arise, and then what?
And then we'll see whether it's right or wrong.
Forever means his line, his dynasty.
I don't know. I don't know what a forever means. Forever can mean forever. Or this arrangement will be here, whatever the case might be. But the point is, my point is that the absence of a Navi creates a new dynamic in which people have to take responsibility. And when you consider the fact that most rabbis don't want to take responsibility to paskin anything major, it's too big for me, or this, or this, or this, and the people who actually do paskin are the ones who are probably the less qualified.
They didn't have a
makom. I'm saying, well, that's that. You know, I mean, the truth of the matter is that that whole question of paskin based on dreams. We talked about this.
Right.
That the Grah, if he worked out something in his head at night, he wouldn't rely on that.
Really?
Because unless he figured it out rationally and with all of his faculties, he didn't rely on that. And he says, no, I'd love a shamayimi. The point is that I'm trying to just point out stress that was involved. It wasn't just a matter. The shift from Nevi'im L'Anshei Knesset Gedolah is a major sea change in the way halacha works. And they're willing to do it, they're willing to take responsibility, but it takes a lot. And I think if we take a look, and we'll take a look at something else in a minute, but I think that that actually helps you understand the three statements that are attributed to Anshei Knesset HaGdola. Hevu metunim vadin, don't rush into anything, be very careful, be deliberate, and so on. Hamidu talmidim harbe, because it's no longer just a matter of one navi, now we're going to have to deal with we have to have some students qualify and be independent. Vasusiag la Torah, it's all the more reason to legislate so you don't come close to the actual possibility of infraction, simply because right now we're on our own. There's no more way of validating what we have. So I think that's exactly why those three things. That's not the only thing that they did. Okay? By the way, they did something else. They did something else. They created a holiday.
These guys. Hanukkah.
They created Hanukkah. Hanukkah. Now it's funny. The Rav used to point out that there is a fundamental shift. There's an interesting difference between the way the Shulchan Aruch was organized and the Rambam was organized. The Shulchan Aruch puts Hanukkah before Purim, and the Rambam puts Purim before Hanukkah. How come? Well, the Shulchan Aruch is obvious because it's a practical code, and you go through the day, you go through the events of the year, and Purim comes before Pesach, and Hanukkah comes before Purim.
Right.
The Rambam puts Purim before Hanukkah not just because of the chronological issue, but because conceptually, it's the first holiday created after Chumash. The whole idea that you could create a post-Mosaic holiday is not so poshut. You have in Dav Gimel Amud Aleph in Megillah, you have the echoes of a serious debate between Esther and Mordechai on the one hand, and the Anshei Knesset HaGdola on the other hand, whether such a thing is possible in the first place. And the only way, the only reason that the Anshei Knesset HaGdola gave in is because Megillah Esther was accepted into the canon. Hanikvar kasub b'sefer. Okay, but Hanukkah, well, no, they were willing to accept the canon since they don't take the holiday.
Uh-huh.
Okay, but Hanukkah has nothing.
Since the night of the Dead Sea Scrolls, could it be that there's like a while you can get in?
What? Which one? Hanukkah or?
Megillah Esther is the only book not found in the Dead Sea Scrolls.
That's a whole. I don't know. That's a whole debate between historians and Chazal, and I don't know. You can't. You know, the Dead Sea Scrolls. You also can't. We don't know enough about the people that live in there, that, you know, what they accept, what they don't. They have all different calendar. They mean, who are they? How many people are they? I mean, it's a whole to do. Maybe. Maybe.
A little too racy, or it's
and the Ethiopians, they claim the Ethiopians, you know, they only have the festival. They only they celebrate. They observe. They observed Purim as a. They observed Purim as a day of mourning, because they didn't get the news that they won. They just got the news about the edict.
Really?
So that's why they explain it. So they only know about the fast of Esther. They don't know about they don't know about Purim. Go now.
If the transition was from the Nevi'im to the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, and then suddenly we see there's someone that's not the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, namely the Maccabees, making certain.
Well, how do you know that they didn't pick up the they didn't pick up from that continue from the like?
But that's what I'm really asking. Do we say that okay, the Anshei Knesset HaGdola was over by the time of the Maccabees?
Yes, I assume so. I assume that's what the next mission is going to say, that the Shimon HaTzadik was among the last of the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. So at some stage of the ballgame, Anshei Knesset HaGdola ceased to function, and
that story was with Alexander the Great.
That's all to do. It's not questionable. It's a question of who was it and what. Which there were two Shimon HaTzadiks. There's a whole to do with that.
So Shimon HaTzadik is 400.
No, Shimon HaTzadik is 200. We generally think that it's
Alexander the Great. It's like 320.
It might have, there are some who claim that the Shimon HaTzadik that the Kohen Gadol who met Alexander was actually Shimon HaTzadik's grandfather. And then, who was also Kohen Gadol?
But the Shimon HaTzadik in the Mishnah.
In the Mishnah lived around the year 200. We think he was probably identical with the same Simon the Righteous who was mentioned in Mishlei Ben Sira.
So this was
which is 200
right.
BCE.
No,
so the Anshei Knesset HaGdola goes from Ezra.
Ezra to around 200.
To
198. 198 is the conquest of Eretz Israel by Antiochus III.
Right.
It's around then. We don't have exact numbers. In any event, so my point is that this is so Anshei Knesset Gedolah is a real that's a real shift. There was an interesting I don't even want to call it confirmation, or at least an echo of this kind of the fact that the nature of Torah Shebal Peh, the way that it was developed, the way that it was derived, what was required of the Chachmei Masorah, takes on added dimensions at the beginning of Vayisheni, is actually alluded to, not more than alluded to, by the Netziv, by Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin. And in a comment he makes at the end of, it's actually related to yesterday too, in a comment he makes at the end of his commentary on Shemot, he has a two paragraph statement which is called Biur Klali al Nes Purim, general interpretation of the miracle of Purim.
This is
the Netziv. Okay, he says, so he quotes the pasuk at the end of the ninth parak of Megillas Esther. V'mei Purim ha'elu lo yavru mitoch ha'yehudim v'zichram lo yosuf mizaram. These days of Purim will never pass away from among the Jews, and their memory will never cease to be among their seed, their children. So he says, Yesh lahavin. We have to ask. We have to understand. Mi hema yudim, umi hema zaram. Who are the Jews and who are their progeny? Halo zera yudim, hema yudim. The progeny and the Jews, the same thing. Why mention it twice? The dochak lomar. It's hard to say. The mitocha yudim mashmao rak bizman Mordechai v'Esther. That first they accepted it just for the generation of Mordechai and Esther, and then later on. They made a separate thing for progeny. It doesn't fit. So he says. So he instead says quick. I want to skip a couple of lines. Then the second word in the fourth line. V'hinei b'Shabbos daf peches amud aleph. And Shabbos the peches amud aleph. The Gemara says quotes the pasuk in the Megillas Esther. Kimu v'kiblu ayudim aleihem v'alzara machav v'alkol ledul v'arechem the acharehem that the Jews. Observed and accepted something upon all of their subsequent progeny. Now the pashut shot in the pasuk is we're talking about the Jews validated that the first generation was just the fighters; they celebrated the victory, and then the following year everybody else got into the act and made Purim. That's what sort of looking for ratified. The takana of Purim into the future. The Gemara says no, that the kimu v'kiblu does not refer only to Purim or in general to Purim, but it also refers to the Torah. In other words, there was a second Kabbalah Satorah at the time of Mordechai and Esther. Kimu mashikiblu kvar. Okay, they re-accepted the Torah. Demishum de betchila kafaleim harga gigis shikablu b'Torah. That initially they were coerced into accepting the Torah because God Kilu picked up the mountain and held it over them and so on. We'll get to a second. He say before we get to that. Shikablu es haTorah ubimei Achashverosh kiblu b'ratzon. But at the time of the Achashverosh they accepted it willingly. Okay. Now the truth of the matter is, when you think about the tough time Moshe and everybody else had with getting Jews away from Avodah Zarah, the entire period of Bais Rishon, and then you see that in the time of Ezra they had this big together, and they're all crying that we didn't keep the Torah, now we have to accept it. It's a Rosh Hashanah, says don't. It's Rosh Hashanah, should eat and drink and be merry because it's Yom Tov, and so on and so forth. You see that there was a shift in attitude. And that Sotosus asked the Kasha there, how is that possible? Share Amru Nasev Nishma. They already accepted the Torah unqualifiedly. Already on the day of Matan Torah. The whole story of Nasev Nishma, it's at the end of Mishpatim, but it happened on the day of Matan Torah. For whatever reason, the Chumash has the whole business from Parshas Mishpatim stuck in between the end of the story of the beginning of the revelation at Sinai and the end of the story when Moshe Rabbeinu goes up to the mountain for the 40th days. But the truth of the matter is that the end of Mishpatim chronologically actually belongs at the end of Yisrael. Okay? So he says, they already said that's the finish, but what happened? Ivra, okay? Ivra, on the So the Medrash Tanchuma says, the Torah Shebichsav Kiblu Barat, so they accepted the written Torah willingly at Matan Torah. Aval Torah Shebal Peh lo ratzu lekabel. But they didn't want to accept the oral law for whatever reason. V'kibluah b'mei Achashverosh.
What written
the Chumash. In other words, they accepted the Chumash, but this is that Tarshim al Peh thing they weren't willing to accept.
Which Chumash did they accept? At
Whatever Chumash was available at the time. According to Rashi, it was up until Mishpatim, and Moshe Rabbeinu finished it by the end of by the time he died, and the other day as the whole thing came down inside it. But whatever the case might be, whatever Moshe Rabbeinu was writing, that they were willing to accept, but the Tarshim al Peh they weren't willing to. In other words, they weren't willing to have an activist Supreme Court. They wanted the Constitution, but they didn't want an activist Supreme Court. We'll stick with whatever is written. So says the Nativ. V'yesh lahavin. So we ask the question. We have to understand. Mahi giyazan es lekabel Tarshim al Peh. What was it about Purim? That caused them to accept at this point in the time of Achashverosh the Torah Shebel Peh, and without going into the details of this long discussion, he basically says that the circumstances were such. Circumstances developed. It doesn't mean the Torah Shebel Peh didn't exist. I mean, there was a question of accepting the authority of Chazal by the people. He says, so the Nesiv says basically that the circumstances had changed in the time of Bayesheni, that even the people could understand that at this point you need to have sharp minds, you need to have guts, you need to be aggressive in terms of interpreting and applying the Torah, and they were ready to accept the necessity and the authority of Torah Shebel Peh in unparalleled circumstances. That's exactly the point. So the Nitziv already is picking, so that's exactly my point. That the Nitziv, we were talking about historical sources here and there, the Nitziv already picks up on the idea that something has fundamentally shifted with the transition from an era of Nevuah, of whatever, or with the beginning of the functioning of the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, within whose purview Purim is legislated, within whose purview, in fact, the rest of the books of Nevuah are canonized. Okay, people begin to realize that this is in fact there's a new era of Judaism's growth, and therefore we must accept the ongoing tradition of Torah Shebel Peh, which, by the way, we see is already operative in the time of Vayisrishin. There were certain types of Vayisrishin things we're talking. For example, but you find it in Psukim. Amos talks about. Let's go Pshuto Shel Mikra. Amos talks about the fact that there are people who are waiting to come into town until after Shabbos to do business. It's not us to do business midaraisa. There's no din midatari. You have to close the shops. Can't write. Maybe no. Muktzah might be the rabbanon. Okay, muktzah the rabbanon. So, muktzah. Okay, you know what? So fine. So muktzah by ochel is the raisa. But you know, I mean, doing business is the rabbanon. So clearly, they're closing the shops. Amos is complaining about the people who want to rip off the poor people who are waiting till Shabbos is over till they open the shops and they rip off the poor people. So you see, already you have things that are rabbanon that are working. So it's not that it didn't exist, but there was this general consensus that something has fundamentally shifted, and that fundamental shifting comes into expression in the activity of Anshei Knesset HaGedola, in the three great statements by which they said express the major issues of their tenure, and by extension, by one of the types of things they did, which was significant legislation in terms of brachas and tefillas and havdalas and
well, this takes away from it. It's
Takanos of Ezra like that.
And it's given at the same time as Torah Shebel Peh.
No, it doesn't. It just says that they accepted its authority. Doesn't mean it didn't exist.
Well,
the Torah can't exist without interpretation.
Well,
there's no question. This Torah Shebel Peh. But there were people, right? But how many people? How many people to this day don't know any better will sit there and say, the rabbis made it up? So where is it written in the Bible? You have that. Yeah, so we did, but that's...
We just had in Shir today, someone told us the mayor held an eye for an eye, means an eye for an eye.
There's the other rabbi.
And around the world, we see eye for an eye certainly works. I mean, that's what many people are... So it's not unreasonable.
The Rambam implies... he implies as much. He says that he says ultimately says more nevuchim. He says you really can't. There's no just way to do it. And says no just way to do it. To have, by definition, has to be monetary. In fact, one Gerson the Rambam has it that that's the way we see every Bezdin from the time of Yoshua ben Nun paskening halacha. Now, in the text that we have, it says halacha le Moshe, but in the Gersa, which is probably the better Gersa, it's halacha le Masa, which is a whole different way of looking at it. The Seder, so you have to look at it, but you don't even have that. Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't know the din in a whole bunch of places, doesn't know what to do with the guy who was the Makalel. He doesn't know what to do with the daughters of Slavchad. He doesn't, I mean, all kinds of stuff he doesn't know what to do. So God has to ask him, what do you mean? So therefore, it's clear that this is an ongoing process. So in Moshe Rabbeinu, everything that he gets said has the status of being part of Torah Shebichtav stuff. But it continues going, and there are all kinds of things that pop up. So it's a question of authority of the recognized authority of the Chachmei Amasara, and here there was an investment according to the Netziv. But we say, okay, finally we get it.
Also, the rabbis override Torah when they feel it's appropriate. So like Hebrew.
No, that's not overriding. That's a question of preference, right? But who says that? By the way, that's still a machlokas after Ashkenazim and Sephardim. Clearly, the Rambam, all Chachmei Sfarad say Yibum is preferable.
Okay,
this is an Ashkenazi business. And what are the considerations? And the considerations are status of women, the consideration of Kavanah L'Shem Mitzvah, there's all kinds of considerations. The question is, yes, it's true. Nobody's going to deny. No one can deny that Yibum is preferable. The question is it applicable at the present time in the circumstances that have been? That's not called bittel.
No, but that's what conservatives say. Well, okay, so we'll drive to shul.
Yeah, but you can't get around the fact that fire is fire.
If it's fire, I mean,
it's
always on. You know, you're on car.
No, but that was the worst. That had to be the dumbest tshuva the conservative movement ever published. I mean, college tshuvas. They have a whole. I read it. I remember. It's a whole to do. They go on and on and on and on and on against the pro. You can't ride on an animal because you might take a switch and break off a branch to give them a switch in the back to have the animal go. And they say, well, of course, the problem of combustion in a car is a problem, huh? The problem with the animal is the least of your problems. The minute you put your foot on the gas, you're increasing the fire. Hagbarasai havar is also. This is the right. So what happened? I mean, the whole thing was really.
Wait, what about here? We go back to Har Sinai.
Yeah.
Where the Hashem is holding the barrel or whatever over the heads of the people.
Yeah.
And they accept.
Torah Shebichtav accepts
the
Netziv.
Under the rest. They're accepting Torah Shebichtav.
So according to the Tzvi, quotes the Tanchuma, that they accepted the Torah Shebichtav because you have other Midrashim. You have other Midrashim in which you have God's going, the famous Midrash Rashi quotes three times as Perushim, which is very unusual for Rashi. He's going around like a peddler to the Torah, they want this with you, the Ishmael, he goes to this one, he goes to that one. Finally, the Jew says, okay, fine, we'll take it. Nasav and Ishmael, we'll take it, and then we'll hear about it later. That's a story of accepting Torah. No, Beirachson. I want it. So says the Tanchuma. So that's the Torah Shebichtav. That they're willing to take because that was all the special effects and they saw it and everything was wonderful. But the Torah Shebichtav was
they accepted it bidaris is what I'm saying.
So according to Beseder, according to the Netziv, they accept the Torah Shebichtav under duress, which therefore anything which is done under duress, so like the Gemara says in Shabbos there, if a guy comes to you and says, sell me your house, and he puts a gun to your head, okay, and you sell it to him, okay, the sale is good. However, you can then take out an ad and say, I did this under duress. And the duress can be traced, and Bezdin can come and be mavat.
No, I'm talking about just imagine the substance. Imagining being there at Har Sinai.
Okay.
And now, under duress, we are going to accept.
No, we're not accepting. We'll take the Torah Shebichtav with no problems. We'll take the Torah Shebichtav under duress because it's a package deal.
What is the content at this point of Torah Shebichtav?
That's a matter of dispute.
Is it content or is it authority? See, over here,
it's content, authority, and method.
Right. So here we're saying it's authority of Chazal.
No, it's also whatever content it accrued.
and accrued from Sinai.
Right.
So at Sinai, what was the reason? Was there content? And was there a thought?
That is a matter of dispute among Chazal.
No, so
I don't know.
How's Netziv looking at it?
The Netziv seems to be talking about method and authority.
Right. Okay, so that
the issue, but the issue of content is not relevant in this context.
Right. That's right. So they, according to Netziv, then they're saying that we want no one. I mean, we'll force ourselves. You want me to say it, but we don't really accept the idea that there will be a peirush to what is being accepted.
Here. I don't know. I can't. I mean, I'm not going to read into the words more than is there.
I thought the idea of rutz over here is a little bit of what you're looking at. You know, if God tells you to do something,
do it.
You're going to do it. What are you, a God?
Right.
So in the Purim story, God is not telling you anything.
Right.
You're seeing God.
Correct.
So therefore, it doesn't have to be God holding up. It's as if He's holding up.
Right.
Because when God speaks to you.
Right. Correct. Very good.
Because
excellent.
What's the choice?
And in fact, I will say something. In fact,
your own will.
Right. And as a result, accepting Tarshu Bal Peh and the authority of Chazal and the need for interpretation and application, and there should be people who are qualified and authorized, is a higher level of religious sophistication.
Yes.
Then anybody can respond to it, to, you know, the sky opening up,
right?
But it takes a tremendous amount of sophistication to realize, to read the signs of the times, as it were, and to say, oh, you know what, this is a dimension of Torah that I need to be able to take into consideration. My ancestors did not. And it is very striking that in the time of Ezra, people are really much more open. They're just like there. It's a whole. They're very happy, and that's without, by the way. Without any open miracles.
But you're talking about 40,000 people.
No, those are the ones who go with them. But
those are the ones, what do you mean?
Who?
The heads of the, when you read the book of Ezra, the heads of all the major leaders of the Jewish community, if you want to call it, or polity, in the land of Israel, in the province of Yehud, sign this thing.
No, but Steve's saying it's a small minority.
Correct. Oh, so that, all right. So then the question is, what right do they have to accept on behalf of all the other Jews?
Right.
So then, look, halachically, I can just tell you this. Halachically, I can tell you that, first of all, not all Jews did it. And they ended up assimilating away. Okay? That speaks to the whole question of, there were approximately 8 to 10 million Jews in the world at the time of the Korban HaBayis. Where'd they all go? And the answer is, they probably all assimilated away. Or became Christians and that's exactly right. So the truth of the matter is, at the end of the day, contrary to what Jews in the diaspora think, the Rambam says explicitly that Am Yisrael halachically is the Jews who live here, and we decide for everybody else.
Right.
Ki mitzion tetzei Torah dvar Hashem Yerushalayim gemara.
The Babylonians accept it. American Jews don't really.
Correct. That is correct. That is correct. Babylonians tried to make a hand run and take it over, but didn't work. But that was later. You have a case, they have a tshuva, a letter of Rav Shririgon, in which he writes, he says, yeah, but you know, we're like the head of the yeshiva here in Babel is like Moshe Rabbeinu, and the yeshiva here is like the Sanhedrin, so it didn't work. But anyway, but the point is that that's true, that at the end of the day, that's exactly the way it works. I won't say who the person is, but many, many years there was a person, a very prominent American rabbi, who would work overtime to get young rabbanim not to go to Israel, not to make aliyah, you have to speak whatever, so on and so forth, you have to devote yourself to the diaspora, and so on. And recently, a year ago actually, we were having lunch, and he finally turned around and said to me, we need you more than you need us, because the future of the Jewish people will be here.
But even though I think when one of you might have been with us in years ago.